Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Oh, yeah. I'm stoked.
Whoa. Really? Seriously?
And apparently it's time
good
to go.
Good God, man.
We were just yakking away. Anything
attention
could have happened.
There's Garrett Lang just, holy cow. My goodness.
Amazing. I thought that was a Drew giggle. Anyway, hello, everyone. I like the part where it says, by your initials, I'm Molly Wood. Hey, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart. Where literally none of us is as smart as all of us because each one of us individually is collapsing like a neutron star.
No joke. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. What do you want to know? Wednesday is where we are. St. Patrick's Day, by the way. But also, and more to the point, time to answer some of all y'all's questions.
Yes. The most fun that you can have lately, I highly encourage it if you are in a bad mood, is to go to Twitter and look at the hashtag Stimmies. Or stimulus, because people are so happy and all the memes about the stimulus checks are hysterical. And it just gets better and better because some taxpayers, of course, are starting to see their stimulus money show up in their bank accounts today, which leads us to our first question from Frederick in Connecticut.
My question is, where is the $1.9 trillion in stimulus money coming from? Is it being raised through sale of bonds or printing presses or what? Please clarify.
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question, Frederick in Connecticut. So it's a little bit of both. Excuse me. First of all, so this money is coming from the Congress of the United States, which has authorized $1.86 trillion in relief spending. And that will be financed by the sale of government debt, bonds in various denominations, right? Basically, IOUs that at maturity will pay you back. You give the government your money, and when the bonds mature, they give you that plus a little bit extra back. Those bonds go out to the entire universe to be bought, foreign countries, individuals, and also, and this is where the government part comes in, the Federal Reserve can buy these bonds as well. And when the Fed buys bonds, it does it by using the magic keyboard in Jay Powell's office. He's the chair of the Fed. Only he gets to use this keyboard, and it creates money out of thin air. And it's a magic keyboard. And so when the Fed does that, it adds to its balance sheet the value of these bonds, and then that cash gets out into the economy. And when all these other people buy the Fed's buy treasuries, it also gets out into the economy. And that is why you're hearing some people say, ooh, could be inflationary, right? There's a lot of money coming in a short period of time. And if the naysayers are right, there will be inflation. Powell just today in his press conference said, yeah, I'm not so worried about it. He, you know, it might spike a little bit, but persistent long-term inflation is not something that's in the cards right now. And Powell's answer to this is, look, there's 10 million people out of work, and the primary pressure for inflation is wages. And so we got 10 million people who don't have any wages. How can you be worried about inflation? But that's where it's coming from. It's coming through a sale of bonds, which will be financed in part by the Fed, but also by the entire universe. And the United States adds $1.86 trillion to its national debt, which is now like 23-something trillion dollars.
I like to imagine a universe in which the entire universe could participate. Like there would be like different planets who were coming to buy like Earth bonds to finance our climate technology. I have a question. I'm like jumping.
Yes,
I'm sorry, everyone. I'm jumping the questions line. Can I want to know a little more about how more money in the economy would lead to inflation. I know this is a basic concept, but I think that it will help other people. And also why it sort of feels like all these like investors and hedge fund people seem to be so worried about inflation. And my vibe is like, are you just mad that like other people in the economy are going to get money?
Yeah. So I think actually, just to answer the second part of the question first, I think in a way that's part of it, right? They're worried that their dollars will become worth less if there is inflation. And look, inflation can be pernicious and it can be a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. And as we know from living memory, right, inflation can get up to the point where the federal funds rate or the rate controlled by the Federal Reserve will be like 17, 18, 19, 20%, like it was when Paul Volcker was running the Fed and when my parents were buying a house. And they were paying 9% interest on a house bought in 1974. So that's why everybody's like, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. But Powell and the people with the – yeah, but wait. But Powell and with the people on the – you know, the people whose job it is are not so worried because they got plenty of headroom. They can raise rates and do all kinds of things. Now, to back up to the first part. The reason inflation happens is when you have a lot of money chasing a constant amount of goods. And the fear now is that there is so much pent-up demand. So many people are ready to spend so much money with a supply of goods that has not yet been able to ramp up that those dollars will chase the same number of goods and people will be, in effect, outbidding each other, right?
Mm-hmm. So prices, consumer prices, all kinds of prices will go up.
Right, right.
So everything in our economy could be like houses. Fun.
Yeah. Yeah. In essence. I mean, probably not.
Interesting.
But you know what I mean.
And
right?
So
but that's the name of the game.
Right. And so what Powell is saying is, A, even if that's the case, we can still always make money a little more expensive so people aren't going to want to like use our credit cards for all this stuff or borrow in the same amount. Right? Is that a fair?
Yes. Yes. I love that you use that phrase, make money more expensive, because that's exactly the deal, right? The tool Powell has is to be able to make money more expensive. Right now, money is free. It is free. You can go to your bank and get money for free. You can borrow. The United States government can borrow at 10 years for 1.6% today, which is fundamentally free. Not as free as it was a month ago, but still free, right? Mm-hmm. And Powell's like, I got my finger on the trigger, baby. I can raise that federal funds rate in a jiffy, and we can take care of that problem.
Right. And then banks will be like, no, you cannot have a loan for your decrepit pool, for example. Or no, you cannot have. Right. Totally.
Right.
And he's and then getting back to the 10 million people who don't. He's saying that the high unemployment rate means that the coordinated demand for goods is reduced because there are plenty of people who don't have enough money because the economy is still hurting.
Right, who don't have the means. 13 million people are behind on their rent. 400,000 businesses have closed. This is not an economy that's firing on all cylinders, no matter what Wall Street tells you.
Yep, totally. I'm really glad we had the stock because it's been bugging me.
Yeah. Super quick,
I want to update people on the... Yeah, please.
I just want to update people on the debt. We are now in debt collectively as a country to the tune of $27.983 trillion. That's where we are.
Wow.
Yeah.
But we don't care about that anymore, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So there we go. All right.
The American government is just like the American people. We're just buying on credit.
That's right.
This has been very educational. Thank you. I super appreciate it. I like that I can ask you the dumb questions and you won't laugh at me.
I get to ask you the dumb tech questions. So it goes both ways, kiddo.
It's all working out. All right. Our next question comes from Anna in Florida, and her question is actually about the Google antitrust lawsuit. She writes, you mentioned the Politico article, which pointed to the failed attempt to curtail Google's powers back in 2012. I'm trying to understand what specifically Google's doing and how it impacts me as a consumer. A New York Times article mentions that if you Google hotels in Niagara Falls, Google pulls up its own results instead of TripAdvisor or some such. So she writes, I Googled. All top items pull up TripAdvisor, hotels.com, Expedia, Kayak, etc. So I'm still unsure of Google's transgressions and impact on consumers. Please make me smart. This is a super interesting question and one that gets at the heart of the way that people are trying to apply antitrust law to these big tech companies, because we have always in the past measured the effect of someone's illegal use of their monopoly power as consumer harm, and that consumer harm was usually defined as higher prices, which is obviously not the case when it comes to Google or Facebook or any free product. And so that means that the harm in Google's case is a little more distributed. Now, lots of companies have sued Google over the way that it displays search results and appears to prioritize its own stuff. So I went to Google and typed in hotels in Niagara Falls, New York, and I get a bunch of ads, right? Expedia, Priceline, hotels. Then I get this box, and this is what companies are really mad about. And this box says, hotels, Niagara Falls, New York. I can, without ever leaving this search results page, I could type in my dates. I could choose the number of people. I could choose, like, I want, why not, a luxury stay, free cancellation. And I could get a whole set of results without ever scrolling down any further and clicking TripAdvisor or hotels.com or Expedia.com, the non-ad version. So that's what those companies are mad about. But the crux of the lawsuit against Google and increasingly Europe's actions against these big tech companies is that they are so big that they have become the gatekeepers of the internet. It is how most consumers access the internet, which means, one, you don't know what you're not seeing. You don't know what company didn't show up on Google's page for whatever reason that its algorithm determined it shouldn't show up. You don't know, in most cases, because Google pays, for example, Apple to be the default search engine on every iPhone, you may have no idea that competition exists and that you could be using a different search engine. And it's a lot harder to find those alternative search engines. And that those search engines, for example, might protect your privacy, which Google doesn't. And because Google is so widespread, we consumers have basically no choice but to be like, yes, we accept your terms of service in which you suck up every possible piece of information about us all the time. And then, P.S., use that giant treasure trove of data to elbow any possible competition
right
out of the way. Because what advertiser is going to say, oh, no, I prefer to be more poorly targeted by a smaller company than Google, which is like, don't worry, I built a digital facsimile of Molly Wood that is absolutely impossible to distinguish from the real one. She's going to want to buy that puffy jacket. So the question of its market power is like bigger and complicated than all the individual pieces of consumer harm. And frankly, that's why in some ways it's taken a long time to put together cohesive cases.
Yeah. And the thrust of that article was the people who study this stuff and actually did the due diligence, the lawyers and the economists, knew in 2011 it was time. And the politician said, no, we're good.
And the politician said, no, thank you. We have, by the way, I'm just going to do this because we have a great interview on this topic coming this week on Tech with this guy, Matt Stoller, who writes a newsletter called Big. And he wrote a book called Goliath, which is just literally all about the monopoly fight in this country for 100 years. And it's pretty fascinating. It's pretty fascinating. I hope that helps. Cool. Tell us if it didn't.
Yeah, for sure. Full show.
All right, keep it rolling.
Okay. So there's that. All right, let's see. Vaccinations. More and more of us are getting shots every single day. I think I said yesterday, I've decided I like the term jab. More of us are getting jabbed every day. I thought it was goofy and a Britishism at first, but I kind of like it now.
It's kind of fun.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's fun.
So I will go back and repeat. More and more Americans are getting jabbed every day. And Steph emailed us a question. She says, short of unforgeable timestamp face tattoos, how could we identify people who are immune and not contagious?
I know really it's like a little sci-fi today, but now I'm imagining a future pandemic where you could have a temporary unforgeable face tattoo that would just be like nano. It would be like nanosites, right? And they would dissolve after a certain amount of time when it didn't matter anymore. Anyway, it's hard to tell. It's hard. I mean, it's obviously hard to tell, which is why apparently the CDC is like, keep wearing a mask and don't do anything fun, even if you get vaccinated.
Right. Jasmine did a story for the show a couple of days ago about exactly this. And the Europeans are talking about a digital green pass. The Israelis on the Daily Show about not the Daily Show, not with Trevor Noah, the one with Michael Barbaro, had an interview with their correspondent in Tel Aviv. Yeah, and it was great. She was like, I went to a concert. There were 500 people there. We all had our digital green pass, and everything was fine, and it's all good. And Biden's looking at vaccination certificates. But, of course, the challenge is, you know, it's all the people in this economy who have not been able to get a vaccine who are going to suffer because they're the ones who are doing the essential jobs, and they're brown and black people and lower-income people. And, look, I mean, you know, there's just a huge inequality thing going on here. There's a privacy thing going on here. It's really, really hard. It's really
And there are people, and this is, believe me, I am going to preface this by saying everyone needs to get jabbed, but there are people who will choose not to for various reasons. And what we are asking ourselves as a society with something like a pass, especially if it means you can or cannot travel, is, I mean, imagine the mask freedom debate times a bajillion. If it's like you didn't get a vaccine, so you can't leave your state.
Yeah.
That one's going to be tricky. So, yes, it is. This is profoundly complicated. And I think it's a huge part. I think the lack of easy solve is a huge part of why the CDC guidelines so far have been so mushy and, frankly, not encouraging for people who are getting the vaccines.
Yeah.
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 One final question before we go. Our favorite kind of voice memo, like we already love a voice memo, but then when you send us a tag team voice memo, oh my God, roll it.
This is Tim.
And this is Lee of Campbell, California.
Kai and Molly, make us smart on leprechaun traps.
We've noticed a new twist on an old holiday and want to know if it was engineered by a certain cereal company.
Elementary schoolers are making leprechaun traps to celebrate St. Patrick's Day.
The idea, if you catch a leprechaun, you'll get a pot of gold.
Our son and his friends in first grade are super, super duper into it.
We noticed the back of this marshmallow cereal now has a leprechaun trap template.
Did General Mills invent the leprechaun trap to boost sales of Lucky Charms?
Thanks, Molly and Kai, for helping us get to the bottom of this critical issue.
Oh, bye.
Bye.
Man. Oh, my God, the double bye. I love them.
Oh, man. So I had no idea what leprechaun traps were until my now junior in high school came home one day in like first, second grade and was like, Dad, we have to build a leprechaun trap. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then he gives me this whole spiel about the leprechaun and gold and this and that. And so we wound up doing a box with it. We had painted green with a stick and a string and this and that. And then, of course, after he goes to bed, I climb in there at night and I figure the trap and I put a little gold coin in there. And anyway, the kid winds up getting a little gold chocolate thingy. Oh, but But apparently, so first of all, no, we called General Mills. They are not the ones who invented the leprechaun trap thing. They're not.
Which, it's how like great Irish is our folklore. Team, by the way? Yes. How great is Marissa Cabrera being like, it's cool. I called GM. I called him. Called General Mills.
We got you covered. Got you covered.
So got no covered. On that one. It's old, apparently. It comes from Irish folklore, a story that says if you manage to capture a leprechaun on St. Patrick's Eve, in particular, you'll be rich for the rest of your life. The legend was then popularized by Walt Disney's 1959 Daughter Be O'Gill and the Little People. And now kids everywhere.
Okay, wait. You make can them. Do North Dakota fine. Stay away from the Irish.
The Irish is not my, I know, it's totally. I always want to go a little Scottish because we watch too much Simpsons. Yeah, it's not my number one accent, sadly. If it was a Russian story, maybe.
It's all good. General Mills did say, though, that whole putting a trap thing on the back of Lucky Charms was actually driven, they said this back in 2019, was driven by fan activity on social media. So they're just tapping into the trend, and you can't blame them. And also, you know, they are magically delicious, you know.
Plus, I think all the kids are home. I bet it's even more, it's just a bigger deal this year because all the kids are home. So, of course, they're all doing it.
Of course.
Also, now I want Lucky Charms because I'm sorry, they are magically delicious. They are. So good.
And,
all right,
and
get
with
us
that,
out of here before we do more ads we, by accident. We
bid you adieu on What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. That was French. I don't know what that was. Back tomorrow, hauling out shell of a Thursday. Keep your questions and comments coming. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Emails are fine. We'll take them. We'll read them. We won't
we'll
like it, though. And we may make fun of you. It would be better if you sent a voice memo.
I was trying to, in my mind, I was sitting here trying to figure out if I could apply my terrible Irish accent to idea, and I decided to spare us all. Yeah. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by the wonderful, talented, and diligent Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our Make Me Smart explainers, which, I have to record. I'm on it.
Ooh. All right. I did mine yesterday. Garrett Lang engineered today down in the studios in L.A. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez did our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer, the executive producer. No, she's an executive director of On Demand. Is Sitar Nieves.
No.
And there you go. No. Just no, Kai. Come on, man.
Just come no. On. I mean, that's good cereal. We're going to get some. What? Donna said Lucky Charms is gross. Mayday.
Oh, Donna. We should have said the former executive producer of this program.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.